Well, thanks, Katrina. Just want to join the others in thanking and congratulating Bob Klein, five-year anniversary. It seemed just like yesterday we were fighting for Proposition 71. I can remember taking it to our Board of Trustees and asking would they endorse it so that we could publicly endorse the initiative. Of course, we did. And so I want to thank you for your vision, dedication, and your enormous passion to this effort. We wouldn't be where we are today without that. And I also want to take this opportunity to acknowledge Denny Sanford for supporting this consortium and bringing the institutions here in the Mesa together. Your courage for what you did, your leadership, and your generosity are just overwhelming. So thank you. I better turn off my BlackBerry. We're going to be here listening to that all the time. The it's 5 years since Prop 71, but about 10 years, I think, since we got really serious about stem cells at the Burnham Institute and, thank you, and started an official program there and began to build a collaborative team of scientists. And the it's exciting to see some of the progress that's been made, also a little bit daunting to still think about much of the challenges still remaining, particularly when we look at going into the regenerative medicine capacity, regenerative medicine aspects of this. Fighting cancer stem cells is one thing, but actually replacing cells and tissues is really taking medicine in some new frontiers that we haven't embarked on before. So when I was asked to say something about clinical opportunities from stem cell research, first, usually when I'm asked to speak at this meeting, I'm in some session about the politics of stem cells or something. I saw I was in a scientific session. I said, well, I don't do stem cell research, actually. And so I started rushing around to try to get slides from my colleagues. And so what I thought I would try to do is just highlight what I see as some of the opportunities, the diversity of opportunities and strategies that we can begin to apply and are applying, of course, to regenerative medicine and stem cells. Some of the challenges that I think we still have ahead of us to see this translated into new medicines. And one component of that I want to mention is that not only, if we have a pointer here, to emphasize, of course, the clinical opportunities, but I don't think we're really going to see this sort of technology broadly translated to medicine if we don't also really understand the commercial opportunities and figure out how to bring the science and the clinical need together. With the commercial opportunities that are going to be necessary to move these all the way through regulatory hurdles and into approved products. I thought I would also take this opportunity to say that while there are many, many unmet needs in terms of what regenerative medicine could mean today and Veterans Day, I think is a good day to remind ourselves of some of the challenges that the dedicated and brave men and women of the armed forces face. And that many of them do come back, unfortunately, with spinal cord injuries, traumatic brain injury, other types of lesions that would really be benefited by progress in this field. Okay, so what I want to try to touch on is three different topics. One is some of the approaches to manipulating stem cells. The other is to how we might think about applying stem cells and some of the different ways we can think about from a regenerative medicine standpoint, applying stem cells, not just replacing cells, but doing other clever things with them. And then talk a little bit about what are the prospects for actually commercializing stem cell research. I start with, and I'll mention all these slides I borrowed from colleagues, this is one I've got from Evan Snyder, with the idea that if we're gonna manipulate stem cells for regenerative medicine purposes, i.e. be able to take stem cells and make the cells we want from them, we're really going to need to develop a number of ways to do that and do that efficiently and to do it at levels that regulatory agencies like the FDA will say, yes, that is robust, reproducible, that you can get purified cultures of this, that, or the cell. And so that really gets us in the area of what it's going to take to propagate and differentiate cells at industrial scale. And the issues there that we deal with are what sort of cell culture conditions can we define. What genetic manipulations might we think of, recognizing that as soon as you start doing that, you're already into some dangerous territory from a regulatory standpoint. You start changing genes in cells. We've seen the side effects of that in the gene therapy world, causing leukemias and other malignancies. And then prospects for whether we could take chemicals and transiently treat cells and get them to differentiate in ways we'd like. We also have to, of course, deal with the issues of what type of cells will be used. Will they be totipotent embryonic stem cells, including the induced pluripotent cells, which I think everyone's very excited about? Can we do things with other types of more committed cells, progenitor cells? And then what about adult stem cells, whether we're trying to manipulate them exogenously or trying to affect them still in the body, which, of course, is the area where there's the most precedent with, you know, drugs like the first one of the first biotech drugs, EPO, erythropoietin, doing that with hematopoietic stem cells. Can we find more examples of that? So adult stem cells, very exciting opportunity, but still challenging. I don't think anybody's figured out how to culture adult stem cells long-term yet, so it's something that is really quite challenging. So the kinds of tools we can envision using: chemicals, proteins, in the culture environment, either gene silencing or gene overexpression, and I'll show you a few examples of that. And I'm going to give some examples from some of my colleagues at Burnham in terms of how these approaches are being applied in with respect to heart disease, diabetes, and brain diseases. So I'll first just talk about some of the things that Mark Mercola is doing to use a chemical genomics strategy to try to take embryonic stem cells, either ES cells or iPS cells, and program and push them to becoming mature cardiac myocytes through chemical library screening. I should add parenthetically that one of the things that we've done as sort of a flagship program at Burnham is to establish a full infrastructure for chemical library screening, screening, chemical genomics, et cetera. And I would encourage any of the scientists in the community who want to take advantage of that to come see us. We are one of four comprehensive centers as part of an NIH roadmap in chemical genomics. And we are ready to work with you and help you take some of your biology and translate in this direction. But what Mark has done is to identify, through studying the normal developmental fate of stem cells all the way to cardiac myocytes, as he's identified different steps along that process where he has marker genes. And the goal simply is then to find chemicals that can push the cells towards each of those states. And one of the simple techniques that's used is to take those marker genes and to clone their promoters and put something like a green fluorescent protein downstream of that, and then you can use that as a readout for whether the cell has been pushed towards its desired fate. So Mark's been able to do that to start with embryonic stem cells and push them all the way to mature muscle cells by using the a marker of a mature cardiac myocyte, and has found different chemicals that help to do that, and has been able to map them to these different stages in terms of where they work in this developmental program. And in fact, he's been so successful with that that he now has chemicals that manipulate just about every one of these steps, different molecules that we've identified through compound library screening that will push cells along this complicated differentiation program. And so the idea is that by further optimizing these, we're doing optimization with John Cashman, who's here, and his group at HBIR and other chemists, we can optimize these and improve the efficiency then of taking stem cells in industrial quantities and moving them to pure populations of cells, such as cardiac myocytes. Then this might make the clinical translation more feasible. Same kind of strategies being used by people like Fred Levine at Burnham, in this case not cardiac myocytes, but beta cells, insulin-producing cells. And here he's devised high-throughput screens using the same kind of idea, a reporter gene, in this case using the insulin promoter, and in a model cell line from human fetal islets, they've been able to rig up a system here that can report whether the a chemical is turning on the insulin promoter and pushing a cell towards a beta cell lineage. And one of the interesting things that came out of this, these are raw data from one of the screens, and all these blue dots here each represent the GFP value from the reporter gene. And we got a few compounds that seemed to stimulate, but not too many. Several compounds, however, that inhibited the reporter gene. And you might think that that's an immediate failure, but one of the things that we can do in collaboration with the chemists sometimes is to take compounds that are antagonists and turn them into agonists through doing some med chem on them. And so, in fact, Fred has been able to do that, and one of these compounds that started off as an inhibitor of this program through Marcia Dawson and a little clever chemistry was able to now make a very robust agonist of this pathway that stimulates the insulin promoter and we think may have a number of applications for diabetes. In terms of, so that just gives you a few examples of using chemicals. In terms of proteins and culture conditions, going back to Mark Mercola and the goal to make heart cells, he's developed technologies in his lab using induced pluripotent stem cells to now fairly reproducibly be able to program them to make fairly pure populations of cardiac myocytes, which have even been studied from an electrophysiological standpoint. He puts various marker genes in them, as shown here, and has now entered into collaborations with some of the cardiology researchers at UCSD who are now taking this out of mouse models where this sort of where cells like this have been used for transplantation for acute myocardial infarction models where you can see activity, and now into the next hurdle needed for clinical translation. That's a large animal model in the area of heart disease. The FDA prefers the pig model to all others, and so that's the next step, and they now have begun the injections and are going to be monitoring now whether this implanting these induced pluripotent stem cells that have been differentiated chromatocytes in this pig model will show a benefit. And that'll be a very important step forward if we hope to see this translate in the patients. On the area of adult stem cells, those were a couple of examples with using embryonic stem cells or iPS cells. There are a lot of different ways to think about this and a lot of different opportunities. One of the areas that Fred Levine is working on at Burnham is in the area of beta cells, and he and his team have found evidence of a primitive population of cells in the adult human pancreas that can be provoked into making new insulin-producing cells, and so we're very excited about that prospect because to the extent that those adult stem cells are there, then it suggests we might be able to make a pill someday that could then stimulate them to start making more beta cells for patients with diabetes. So among the techniques that we're using there is siRNA library screening to try to find new targets for drug discovery. And Fred has begun to apply that in some of the model cell lines we've talked about to find out which genes one can knock out or silence to then push the cells towards becoming beta cells, and those would then be candidates for small molecules that would mimic that same effect. And then finally, an example of gene transfer with some work that Stuart Lipton's doing in the area of producing neurons. Stuart is a co-discoverer of an interesting transcription factor called MEFC2C, and he showed that if one puts that into embryonic stem cells, that it programs them on an important step towards becoming brain cells. And he's been able to show that with a little retinoic acid and with this gene, you can very efficiently drive pluripotent stem cells towards neuronal lineages and get pure populations of cells that way. So yet another example of some of the, I think, exciting progress, early days, but exciting progress being made in being able to manipulate stem cells. In terms of applying stem cells, I think, you know, we all started off from a regenerative medicine standpoint thinking that, well, we're going to replace cells. This is true. But work coming out of a number of labs, including Evan Snyder's at our institution, is suggesting that you can do a lot of other creative things with stem cells that really broaden the types of applications we might think about. And I'll go through some examples of these and show you what I mean. In terms of replacement, of course, that seems fairly straightforward, and some of the wonderful progress being made there by Evan Steiner and his group is in the area of Parkinson's disease, where they have now been able to go from mouse and rat models all the way now into the large animal model, in this case the primate, which again is going to be the bar the FDA is going to want to see you clear before you go into patients. And they have been able to take advantage of the fact that this particular neurodegenerative disease involves a discrete lesion in the brain in the substantia nigra where there's specific loss of dopaminergic neurons. So unlike a number of other diffuse brain diseases, you have a specific anatomical location in which you can envision implanting cells that would make dopamine. And so from these primate trials, which were successful, you can see examples where they create a pharmacological lesion that causes Parkinsonian symptoms develop. They then put in the stem cells, and now they subside. in a sham surgery, operated animals shown down here at the bottom. They do not. And so these give very promising results. It suggests that with these sorts of approaches that Evan and others are using, that we may indeed be able to envision a day where cell replacement will be possible in the context of certain neurological diseases. But I think even more exciting are some of the things that have been found in terms of the way stem cells can help host cells. For example, I think you're all familiar with several labs now have shown the impressive results in rodent models of stem cells applied in spinal cord injury models. And this shows an example from some of Evan's work where they've done spinal cord injury in rats, if I can get the movies to run. And you see here an example of a rat that's been subjected to spinal cord injury, and it can barely move its lower extremity. But then in rats in which they put stem cells on a particular biomaterial, you get much better results there, where the animals don't have entirely normal gait, but very good ambulation. And these types of results have been very exciting ways to suggest that, wow, we could do some amazing things with stem cells. The interesting thing about this, and thinking about what's happening, where you have nerve cells that are projecting axons, often of several feet, to muscles, is that when one is putting stem cells into the spinal cord, injured spinal cord, what Evan found is that they're not replacing cells, but what they're doing is they're protecting the endogenous cells. And what's going on is that the stem cells, in this case using neural stem cells, are talking to the host tissue and exchanging signals, factors, et cetera, that are helping to keep the host cells alive and healthy. And he's also found evidence in that Parkinson's model that I showed you that that's what's going on, and has found that one of the things these cells release is GDNF, a neurotrophic factor that helps to promote survival of certain types of neural populations. And so we can think of using the stem cells as a way of delivering a growth factor, if you will, locally where it's needed into the diseased tissue. The same thing, I think we can think of stem cells as simply a different way of doing gene therapy. And Evan has shown, for example, that in patients, in animal models of patients of hereditary diseases like Sandoz disease and Tay-Sachs disease, that one can take stem cells that now replace missing enzymes, put them in the brain, and have them make that brain that enzyme locally, and therefore correct these lipid storage diseases. He's also done tricks with taking stem cells and arming them with molecules that they can use to attack cancers, and doing models of brain cancer and showing that, again, you can use the stem cell to deliver the therapeutic protein where it's needed and have them almost track down the tumor cell. And then finally, in the area of sort of supporting cells, some of the exciting things going on there, I think, are in the area of heart disease, where stem cells are being used to provoke angiogenesis into diseased myocardium. Lots of different trials underway. I'll just highlight one from a friend down the street, Richard Schatz, who at Scripps Clinic, who's been taking hematopoietic stem cells and injecting them into the diseased coronary arteries of patients with heart failure. And though numbers of patients are small and it's very preliminary data, these CD34-positive hematopoietic stem cells injected into patients seem to be reducing the number of episodes of angina and improving exercise tolerance. As one looks at the patients. And so these give us hope that stem cells can be used to do other tricks as well that go beyond simply replacing tissue. So anyway, so diversity of opportunities that we can think about from stem cells, and it's really quite exciting to envision what we might do. Can we commercialize any of this and find ways to really make this attractive from a business perspective? And I think that's really what we are struggling with. As we think about that, we can think about whether we're trying to do things in vivo or ex vivo. Are we going to be making products or supplying services? Is this going to be a pharmaceutical model versus a hospital model, like hematopoietic stem cell transplants that are used now? Regulatory paths in terms of the FDA and other regulatory authorities around the world, like EMEA, still largely undefined for most of these. And reimbursement, we're all concerned about healthcare costs, also undefined at present. So these are substantial barriers, and they have been barriers to many investors, as we well know. There are many opportunities from in vivo products, some that would be more like traditional drugs, like biotech drugs, like protein drugs that might stimulate endogenous adult stem cells, chemical compounds that might do the same, and then cell transplantation, which I think is the biggest area that of unknown. One exciting, promising area there, though, I think, is in using biomaterials together with stem cells, biocapsules that encase stem cells and sort of keep them away from the body so you could actually take them out if you needed to from a safety perspective, but also allow you to use allogeneic cells. And to that end, one of our colleagues, Pam Itkin-Ansari, is collaborating with Theracyte here, and they've been working out techniques for taking progenitors of beta cells that make insulin, implanting them into capsules, and they've now taken this all the way into a primate model, where they've been able to show that in diabetic animals that they can restore glucose homeostasis, and that if you look by imaging studies at the beta cells in not in the capsule, they get destroyed in the animals because they're from a different species. For the immune system, but if you have them in the capsules, they survive. And so also exciting results that are now to the level of a large animal model, and again, an important hurdle for FDA and an indication that we may be able to get some of this all the way across the goal line and into the clinic. Ex vivo products, many, many opportunities, and so I think I'll just put that there, and you can see that there's quite a range of things that we can be thinking of from business opportunities, including bioproduction and other areas. So I'm going to close there. I again tried to take sort of an eclectic tour through some of the areas of stem cell research that I think offer exciting new opportunities. Also point out what I think are a few of the challenges that we have yet to face. But hopefully leave you with a lot of optimism and excitement that there's great progress being made. We've been about a decade at this at our institution, and the good news is we're about halfway there now, probably. Maybe another decade, and we'll see some of this actually translating into the clinic. But it's exciting to see the progress made, and thank you for your attention.